You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Saturday, November 23rd, 2019, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Yeah. We are live in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Kara finally lured us out to her neck of the woods.
We're
doing a show in front of a live audience. Joining me this week, as always, is Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Los Angeles.
And joining us, as he often does, our partner in crime, George Robb.
I love L.A.
Can I say that and you guys say we love it? I've never got a chance to do that. So ready? I'm going to go, I love L.A. And you guys, we love it. I love L.A.
We love it.
That really works.
I want to try one. I love George's underwear.
We love it.
They do.
So we're all gathered in Los Angeles because we're on our way to New Zealand and Australia for the two conferences down there.
Well, this is the main focus of our trip. And we said, while we're here, let's go to Australia and New Zealand.
Yeah. While we're in LA, we're halfway right on. We're partway there. We might as well just keep going.
It's a great booking agent.
But we are here. And George is with us. George, right? Because we are doing this today, this afternoon, in a couple of hours, a few hours, is our first live performance of the Skeptical Extravaganza 2.0, our re-jiggered, reimagined,
rebooted, restarted.
Our stage show.
Prequel, sequel.
You feeling good?
Sequel. I am so excited. Yeah. We are sold out for this afternoon, which is a great.
All 20 tickets sold.
All 20 tickets sold. My mom, my dad, my cousins, we're all good to go. Actually, Evan pointed out this great thing that the marquee might not only have our name on it, but it might also say sold out, which, like, to have a marquee that's sold out is so cool.
I hope they do us right by that.
We're hoping. We'll see. Or it'll say Puppet Show, Skeptic's Guide to the Universe underneath it.
Or tomorrow night, Band XYZ or whatever.
Yeah. Plus marijuana dispensary, CBD dispensary.
No. We love it!
5 points. Excellent.
Kara, I love being in L.A. I mean, you instantly get an L.A. vibe, right? So, of course, for breakfast, I had a hummus brown rice bowl.
I love it.
I was disappointed it didn't have quinoa.
No. You didn't have avocado toast.
No avocado toast.
There were like four avocado toasts
on
the menu.
But there was kale in the salad, of course. Yeah.
I had an egg sandwich. I said, can I have ketchup on that? He's like, he looked puzzled. Then he's like, do we have ketchup? And somebody said, yes. Like, yeah, we got ketchup. But then I got my egg sandwich, didn't have ketchup. Oh, good, but.
And of course, there's no artificial sweetener, right?
Because stevia.
Stevia tastes like
fine.
Ass.
I don't like it. I use real sugar today.
It's better than a yellow crap.
No, it isn't.
No, yellow crap. Yellow.
Yellow or blue?
Yellow is splendid, man. Splendid.
No, I'm sorry.
The blue crap. The pink
Yellow and blue are my go-to.
Yeah, pink stuff gives you cancer.
No, it doesn't.
here we go.
That's an example of the dose makes the poison, right? Which is an important skeptical concept. I remember the rats would have to drink 9
rats.
No. So the rats
Big
got the
rats.
Cancer,
right.
And they extracted.
It was the equivalent of 30,000 cans of Coke a month or something.
It was crazy, like 9-liter bottles a day. So come on.
But the pink stuff has this childhood memory, because that was the only sweetener available when I was young,
sugar.
Other than sugar. Yeah. And so it was like, oh, you get to do this like free calorie thing. And so that bitter metallic, like you're licking a wall socket kind of flavor, has this very like childhood. It's
nostalgic.
Like nostalgic appeal. So
how is that nostalgic?
I miss my dad.
Whacking my ass when I was a kid. How do you miss something? It tastes like shit.
I don't know. It's like being molested by a priest. You kind of miss it in a way.
Tab.
I still buy Tab. I still get Tab. It's amazing.
What's in Tab?
Saccharin.
That's the first diet.
Yeah, I think it was.
No. Pepsi Light. What? Was the first diet soda. Don't know about
that. Before Tab.
I think before Tab. Yeah, Pepsi Light had a lemon flavor to it.
Ew.
That was, oh, it was great. It was awesome. And then, yeah, and then the saccharin, which just gave you this, like your tongue would just leave your mouth for like a day and then come back and be like, what are you doing?
Yeah, I drink like the red can Coke.
Yeah, the high-tech
like
stuff.
Yeah, the full
Well, that's
on,
just full of sugar.
Or like the Hecho in Mexico, like the bottled stuff.
Yeah, but that's like nine tablespoons of sugar.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
We learned that Nexus... that there is no taste difference between regular Coke and
that's
Diet
true.
Coke.
Or that's skim shocking. Milk and whole milk.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about, I was having breakfast with some...
Yeah, you tested the wrong
with some.
I
was telling people that story this morning.
I did the chips, right? I was tested the chips,
yes.
And I got it right.
Yeah,
it was, fake Doritos versus whatever.
50-50, yeah.
The whole milk, skim milk thing.
The soda I could have gotten.
And Evan also tested the very small condom and the extra large condom. And he said they were both loose.
He's getting... He's getting all of the jokes out in the private
That's
show
the
because
private
we've got
show.
To be on stage.
That's
soon.
What I can do.
But I love it. It's a perfect example of the unintended consequences of, you know, following ideology instead of science, right? So people want to be healthy, so they'll eat the raw sugar, right, because it's natural and not the fake Equal or Splenda, meaning it's much more unhealthy for you. First
Absolutely.
Of all, there's that, nothing. There's no problem with artificial
sweeteners. Steve, does that mean I can have raw cashews? Eat a whole handful of those?
Yeah, raw
cashews,
I'm good. Raw almonds.
But it's all chemicals, Steve.
Chemicals.
Right, so people are literally, like I'll never forget the individual who told me that they smoked, but they only smoke organic tobacco.
No problem.
It's just,
wow.
Getting distracted by... The marketing,
whatever you
crap.
Gotta tell yourself.
So I had a conversation once with a woman who did. It was a friend of a friend, and she didn't vaccinate her kids. We're at a campfire. We're sort of hanging out, and this subject comes up, and just every sort of cell inside your body kind of just goes, "Here we go." Like, what do we go? Red pill, blue pill. What are we gonna do here? Like, do I start this conversation or not? And she's sort of talking, well, because it's, you know, it's not really safe. And she's rifling through her bag as she's talking about how she's decided. And, you know, I have to send them to school with these notes that say we pretend that it's a religious preference, and that way we get it allowed. And she's rifling around. And she pulls out a pack of Marlboros.
Yeah.
And she pulls the Marlboro out and she lights it. And I'm just like, do I even start to have this conversation, or should I just start smoking myself?
It occurs to me, like,
unbelievable.
Try to follow me on this. Being a skeptic is kind of like being a conspiracy theorist, because we see, that's bullshit, and that's bullshit. You know, it's very similar. Like, conspiracy theorists think of that; they think in those terms. Like,
they're pseudo skeptics.
Yeah,
pseudo skeptics.
Yeah.
Whereas we actually sort of see it because we have the data.
Well, we really believe
Hopefully.
That we're right.
We have a process.
That's right. There's a process. Yeah, we have a process.
We have a process.
Right.
Yeah, it's not the thing that we believe, it's just the process.
Right.
All right, but speaking of all this.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the first segment for, which is going to be a main segment for this episode, each of us is going to pick one time in our lives where we confronted a true believer or a true belief. It could be an individual, or it could be an issue where we bring in multiple, you know, our experience across many people for that one issue, and then discuss how we dealt with it, right? How do we deal with it when confronted with someone in your life who believes X, right? So we all have different examples. Kara, do you want to go first since you're hosting us in your hometown?
Sure. I think I changed my example from the one I wrote in our Google Doc.
You can't do that.
I'm doing it. So
this is an unapproved topic.
It's an unapproved topic. So sorry, guys.
Through the looking glass.
Yeah, because I was thinking about living in LA and kind of the chapter that I wrote in the SGU book about Hollywood and like some of the friends that I have here and some people I've dated and all the weird skeptical stuff or pseudo scientific stuff that they're into. And, you know, I think I've had to deal with that quite a bit, but none of those things were, I don't know, terribly salient for like my development. And when I think about something that was really impactful for me, and you say true believer, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is that I was raised as a Mormon.
Yeah.
So like in a very kind of fundamentalist household. And I would say that probably the thing that I have to, or the person that I have to choose is my own father. So I was born and raised into the church by my two parents who both converted together. They were both Catholic before that because my dad's Italian, my mother's Puerto Rican, so of course they were Catholic. And they converted to the church when they got married. They had my older sister, then they had me. Born and raised in the church. I don't know if I ever actually, you know, people say, like, what's that moment you knew? And it's like, I just don't think that happens. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that's an unfair question. Like, what was that moment when you decided you were going to do this for a living? It's like, I don't know.
There may be.
Sometimes.
Yeah, I think that's the exception, not the rule.
Exactly.
Though.
I think most people it iterates and just, you know, things happen. So
I remember mine. Steve said to me, Jay, religion's bullshit. I'm like, okay.
Okay. Yeah, Steve. And so imagine, right, growing up in the Bible Belt and the suburbs of Dallas in a Mormon family, and you're like in it, right? It's 3 hours every Sunday, youth group every Wednesday night, seminary before school every morning from 6 until 7 a.m.
What is that?
That's
just religious instruction?
Religious instruction for high school kids. So kind of indoctrination to keep you, I guess, in the religious mindset before you go to like these secular schools that are really dangerous.
So what flavor Kool-Aid do they give you when you're
all the Kool-Aids. What?
6 a.m. to
6 a.m.
to when?
7 a.m. So right before school, it's how I learned to drive, which was kind of nice, because my dad let me use my learner's permit because there's no one on the road on the way to church, which was, I guess, one benefit. But when I was 15 is when I was questioning to the point where it was becoming overwhelming, and I was starting to feel like I needed to have kind of a coming out moment. You know, I think a lot of people who have gender identity differences or who have orientation differences, I shouldn't even say differences, but non-whatever, gay, lesbian, transgender, you know, people who have this coming out moment. And I do liken it unto that, this idea of like, I've been lying to myself. I've been living a life that doesn't seem to match the life that I feel like inside.
You think it just like builds and builds and builds until it gets,
until
it
it's unbearable.
Has to explode.
Yeah. Because it's like, you can only suppress for so long. And when everything in your life is like requiring conformity to a norm that doesn't feel true to yourself, at a certain point, you start to feel like there's like a deviancy in you. Like, I'm lying to myself and to everybody else. So at that point, I brought the questions to my father and I said, you know, I'm really questioning my faith. And it's not just my faith in the Mormon religion, but it's my faith in God. And some of you have probably heard this before if you've listened to the show a lot, but I said, you know, I'm trying to figure out what to do with this, hoping that he would approach it as, because he had been a former, he had held the high priesthood and he had, you know, been in a position where he should have some capabilities, like philosophical, conversational capabilities. And, you know, there aren't really priests in the Mormon church, they're bishops, but he had been in those positions before. And instead of being like, let's talk about these questions and let's explore this, he basically said, I have a moral obligation to God to force you to go to church until you're 18 years old, as long as you live under my roof. And at this point, my parents were they were divorced. I had joint custody. I was 15. I was like, you know, probably if we went to court, I'm of an age of consent where I could say, this isn't the choice that I want to make anymore. It's unfortunate because I felt like I was pushed into a decision that I didn't want to have to make. But ultimately, I felt it was more important for me to be true to who I am than to continue to go to his house every weekend and go to church. So yeah, for the next 4 years, I don't think I really spoke with my father. It took a while to rebuild those ruptures, and we ultimately did. It's still difficult. He's still pretty fundamentalist. My mom ultimately left the church. She's always been really supportive. But yeah, my dad, most of his kids, he softened with age because he adopted 3 boys that were older, and it's really hard to like convince a 16-year-old to be Mormon. Mm-hmm. You know? Like, it's much easier if you raise them from birth.
Yeah.
So
it's tough to convince 16-year-olds to do a lot of things.
Yeah, exactly. So, and they adopted older kids.
My impression is, you tell me if this is correct, from what you just said, it sounds like your father copped out. Like, he tapped out. He said, all right, I could have a long philosophical discussion with you to help you on your journey towards, you know, solidifying your faith, or I could just say, listen, I'm obligated to take you to church. Other than that, you're on your own. That's kind of
it's this weird thing, like, because he's a smart guy, right? And he, you know, he does all the things that most Mormons do, where they struggle with their faith and they bear their testimony once a month, where they talk about all the things that have reinforced why they believe. And I don't know, it's weird. It's like, maybe there was a part of him that knew that I just didn't have it and I never was going to.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of
he knew
like,
it was hopeless.
We just got to go through the motions right now.
He's a lost cause.
It's also kind of strange.
He knew me, right? I was 15. He had known me for 15 years and I was never like in it, even though I was baptized and did everything. But you know, the weird thing real quick about the Mormon church is that you get baptized when you're 8 years old. Because in their view, 8 years old is an age where you're old enough to consent. Like you've decided that that is the lifestyle you want or that you actually believe. But I'm like 8 years old. Like, I know.
That's why you get your license when you're 8 years old, too.
Yeah, people that made that decision did not have an 8-year-old at the time.
Yeah, or they made that decision in like the 1700s when they were like marrying 8-year-olds. Yeah. I mean, it's this really crazy thing where
No, it's the illusion of it's the illusion of
it's that's yeah, really what yeah. it is. Yeah, it's an illusion. It's like they can sanctimoniously say, "Well, we don't baptize you as babies. Right. We're going to let you sin, and then you can wash yeah. yourself of those sins."
Yeah, because you know, taking that toy from that other 8-year-old, I know. Man, what a sin!
Yeah, and the thing is, as an 8-year-old, put yourself in the position of an 8-year-old child. What is the most important thing to you? Like your parents loving you and accepting you.
They're
your whole world. You believe everything they say and you just want their approval. And so, of course, I'm going to be like, yeah, I'll get baptized. I'll do anything you want me to do. But even from 8 years old, I mean, I was like a problem child at the church. I was like being like, well, that doesn't pan out, you know, and they're like, let's just get through the lesson.
Isn't there a special place for like kids that unfortunately die before 8? Isn't there a special like chunk of heaven? Is it purgatory
or limbo? It's not just for, so
that's Catholic, though.
Right. Yeah, long story short, in the Mormon faith, there is no hell. There's something called outer darkness, which is like the worst place you can go. Because in their view, like the glory of God is the warmest place you can be. And that's the celestial kingdom. That's for like Mormons who have like gotten married in the temple and who have done all of their, followed all the rules exactly, right? Been sealed to their family. So they're in the celestial kingdom. They're legit hanging out with God.
So God's like a bug zapper.
God's like a dude.
Yeah.
Maybe he has a bug zapper. Like that cool one you sent me. That's the tennis racket bug zapper. He sent me one of those after I was chasing a mosquito around in
my
house.
We're doing a show and she's like, these bugs. You know, she's complaining and everything.
I was getting eaten alive during a recording.
And I'm like, ding, ding, ding. I know what I got to get you. It's the tennis racket bug zapper.
It's the best thing
the
ever.
The satisfaction. If you get a big one.
Yeah.
And smoke starts coming off.
And it weirdly smells kind of good.
Yeah, the whole experience.
Works on insects and small children.
And small children. Yeah. Actually, there is a warning on it. But anyway, so yeah, Celestial Kingdom
is... One of us at your door.
There's something about... something about bug zappers, and that's where God is. And then the terrestrial kingdom is like heaven on earth, and then the celestial kingdom. And then there's this like in-between state, and that's for people who never rejected. So it's either you've like had the chance to have the gospel and then like uphold it, or you never even had a chance. And in the Mormon faith, they're like, we don't hold that against you. And that's why they do baptisms for the dead. Right. So anybody who never was exposed to Mormonism.
You take the corpse and
they do it in the name of the dead body. It's really weird. You do it and you do it as a youth.
But what's it like? I like it. I want to get down to like the nuts and bolts.
Well, here's the thing.
I'm not in the outer darkness. I'm in the limbo darkness, right?
Yeah.
What do you do?
Oh, they don't tell you that.
You know, like, what's happening to those souls that are in that thing?
I think the thing is, it's just like life.
Is it like New Jersey?
It's like Jersey. It's like you're just hanging out, and there's, like, nothing going on.
A lot of Jenga.
But you're not, like, you're not, like, in the glory of, like, the Lord or whatever.
Yeah. All right.
But here's the messed up thing, and I think it's one of the things that first started to wedge my faith a little bit, even though, like I said, I don't think it was really ever there, is that there's this idea of the kingdoms. And in the Mormon faith, you're allowed to get divorced. So my mom and my dad are married, and they have me and my sister. And then they get divorced when I'm like 6. Mm-hmm. And then my dad remarries this other Mormon lady who already has her children with a previous marriage. So they get sealed together in the temple. So now they, in the eyes of the church, are going to be in the celestial kingdom with me and all their kids that are sealed to them. But my mom is like hanging out in the terrestrial kingdom. Mm-hmm. And because this is a layered thing, I can visit her at any time, but she can't come visit me, my own mother.
You can slum
but I'm hanging out with this new lady who's like the wife of my dad. And I'm like, how is this working out? It's like every time I start to get into the logistics of it, I was like, not only does this not make sense, it's like kind of really immoral.
Yeah.
And that's when, ding, ding.
There is no way that people didn't figure out a way to sneak people in for a lot of money into the upper echelon.
Well, that's what baptisms for the dead are.
You're sneaking people in.
That was Martin Luther's whole thing. You know, the whole indulgences where you would pay the church to have your relatives get into heaven. Your dead relatives get into heaven.
Of course.
Yeah. Martin Luther was like, what? Yeah. Like, how can you possibly prove or what?
Exactly. I mean,
so
I was joking about
it. It's an extension of it. It's all the same.
I think the whole misappropriation thing is absurd. But the idea that you could be like, okay, so we have a dead, you know, person in our past, and who knows what they believed, who they were, were they a good person? You know, they could have been anything from a mass murderer to, you know, a really great person. And we're just going to whip them into our heaven?
I guess in their view, and of course, why am I even justifying this? But in their view, they would not have been exposed yet to the teachings of the church. So they view that as an unfairness in life because the church is brand new. And so, So, and only in America.
Well, we've seen this before, though.
It's like a vaccination, sort of, like in a weird way. Like we are offering your deceased relatives to be vaccinated post hoc kind of thing. And it's our responsibility. Yeah. We have to save them.
But if somebody, but like me, I'm like deluded. I'm screwed according to, and this is why I think my father, it's really hard.
Oh, because you've been exposed.
I am baptized and rejected.
You're in the outer
darkness.
You're the worst. It's actually worse than being like a murderer or a rapist or somebody who, and don't get me wrong, they're a works-based religion, not an only, it's a works and faith-based religion combined. So they don't believe that if you're like a murderer, you can just be like, sorry, I accept Jesus, and then like you're going to heaven. You have to also have lived a really important life.
But can't someone that, you know, one of your, kids or grandkids, if you could, they whip you in, you know, like that, pull you in with the baptism.
No, because I was already baptized.
So yeah, so they can't even. There's no getting rid of it.
There's no unbaptism.
No. I am going to outer darkness with the gnashing of the teeth.
I'll see you there.
So you're a squatter at that point.
I'm basically would be excommunicated from the church if they cared enough to do the paperwork.
That would be actually pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean,
you hang that certificate right on your wall. Yeah. You frame that one.
They're still trying to get me back, like, because my father keeps telling them where I live. So, like, periodically, missionaries will show up at my door. And apparently there is, like, a paperwork process to be like, I am choosing to be off the rolls.
Yeah.
But, like, why do I have to do that?
Yeah, right.
Shit? Like, out of principle, I don't want to have
Karen,
to file the paperwork.
If I were you and I see them coming up the driveway, I would have something prepared. I would be like, get naked and do some weird, you know, make the weirdest scene I could possibly, and like open a door and be like, hey, what do you want? We would like you to rejoin the see you later, you know? Like,
yeah, totally.
But the assumption running through everything that you're saying about the Mormons is that they are the one true faith, right? Yep. Everything that is, but it's worth explicitly saying, it all makes sense if that's your premise.
Yeah, and they explicitly do say that. The problem is sitting here as somebody who has never scholastically studied the LDS faith, is that I unfortunately have a cloudy view of the faith because I grew up in the faith as a girl. And as a girl, you're not privy to a lot of the information that is out there because it's a deeply entrenched sexist religion, like most religions, like all religions. It's very patriarchal. Only men can hold the priesthood. And one of the things that was really frustrating for me is that during youth group, where the boys were usually like in Boy Scouts and they were learning how to like start fires and to tie knots and to like, you know, do nautical stuff, we were learning how to bake cookies. Like, it was really overt, the sexism.
Yeah, that's a good point.
All the cookies. But that's the thing. It was basically homemaking class. And it was really frustrating that there's still this implicit view that girls should grow up to serve. When my sister got married, she and her husband did the dirty before they were married. And so they were not able to get married.
Straight to the outer darkness.
Yeah. Well, no, they're fine. But they couldn't get married in the temple. Got married in a church marriage instead of a temple marriage. So I was able to watch the ceremony. And I remember I was crying, and not because it was so beautiful, but because the thing that the bishop said was like, do you, husband, take wife to be, you know, whatever and blah, blah. And do you like serve the Lord in every decision that you make so that it's a moral and just and blah, blah, blah. I do. Mm-hmm. Do you, wife, take the husband, blah, blah, and serve him in every... And it was this, like, really gross... Like, and my dad was trying to explain it to me. He's like, well, you know, via transitive properties, like, you, the woman is connected to God through her husband. And I was just like, what is this? Like, it's so oppressive. It's so overt. And it's so weird to me that there are literally thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, maybe millions, I don't know how many Mormons there are.
That's a lot,
it's all over the world, who like are just cool with it. Yeah.
Well, because they got a cool word, transitive process. That makes it sound like, oh, that's cool. All right. That's cool.
I think that was my dad trying to flex his physics muscle
just
there.
Just go bake some cookies.
Yeah. Exactly. So yeah, that's that. I don't want to bake cookies, so I'm not Mormon.
Is that why whenever I have cookies, I always say, more, man?
Yes.
I like it.
All right, with that, let's move on to
Zenith the show.
Go ahead.
So mine's going to be different because I'm going to read to you. I've said this on the show a few times. I'm having a battle online.
Oh, boy.
Having a battle online.
Who isn't having a battle
online? Someone that I know. I can't give you any more information than that.
Okay.
It's Bob.
I got very personal there, Jay.
You always start with relevance.
No, this
and
then is. I can't. This would be painful for me. So I'm not. There's no reason to do it. But I'm going to read to you some amazing shit. This is one post.
out of dozens, more than dozens.
This is a real person?
This is real.
A real person you
know. I'm going to call the guy Frank. Frank puts a post on Facebook. Of course, this is due to global warming / climate change. And the article talks about Utah sees record cold, -43°F, perhaps the lowest October temperature ever recorded. Right? So I read the article, and indeed, there was some crazy low temperatures. So I write back, it's comments like this that prove you really don't understand the science. Global warming doesn't mean all temperatures go up at all times. It means the average global temperature is up. Global warming creates more severe weather events due to higher energy in the ocean and atmosphere. We're seeing stronger storms, hotter average days, and colder average days. Extreme weather is a predicted result of global warming. Frank says, but the history shows almost the exact opposite. This attribution to climate change is ridiculous. We had much worse snowstorms, hurricanes, tornadoes, tsunamis hundreds of years ago. Go look up the largest hurricanes in order of size and the other storm events. Many were in the 1800s, !2. It is hard to find actual history now because Google and others are all believers and help spread this political agenda. Again, you are wrong. Also, the media jumps on any news about weather that supports global warming. Hottest June ever. That is exactly what you are saying not to do. You can't have it both ways. This is me. How am I having it both ways? I've never argued on the side of the media. Not once. Oddly, you are the one who reposted an article about an extreme cold weather event. And then I said, are you saying that Google is hiding historical information about the weather? And then he quotes me. It's comments like these that prove you really don't understand the science. That's what you wrote me. And I'm condescending because I called him condescending in a previous post. I was a physics major, always kept up with actual science, but much more importantly, there are many higher acclaimed scientists that say there is no correlation between CO2 and temperature, that the climate change has become political and exaggerated. I listen to these people. So I said, you are posting comments that demonstrate you clearly don't understand climate change. I have politely pointed that out. I'm sorry if you take offense to me pointing that out. Again, I will remind you, the vast majority, 97%, and you'll hear me say that a lot, of climate scientists disagree with what you think is going on. If you choose to listen to a tiny minority of scientists, then you are considered to be an outlier. Arguing that a handful of scientists agree with you actually takes away from your overall argument. You also made a false statement about science being hidden to the public by Google and the media. This is false because of the thousands of science journals that exist. If you knew about the existence of science journals, you would not have made that comment. Your physics degree seemingly did not give you a working knowledge of how science functions and what is considered legitimate science. Try not to take...
How much more?
You got to get through this. I'm building a case because what I'm doing is I am responding painstakingly reasonable. And this gets bad now.
Okay.
I said, I respect you. I am motivated to help you understand the flaws in your logic and also fill in the gaps.
Can I ask real quick? You know this person in real life?
Yes. Okay.
All right. Make
meat
sure.
Space.
This is probably one of the most important things that I want to read to you.
Oh, yeah,
you can't seem to understand one basic problem. Everything you believe is a lie.
Who said that?
I can't tell you who said it.
No.
Frank said it.
Frank to me.
Everything you believe is a lie. That 97% of scientists' nonsense has been debunked. Science journals, what a joke.
Whoa.
They are all left-wing controlled as our most published material. The media controls the Democratic Party. All their Republicans are racist, homophobic, xenophobic bullshit. That's why you have all these stars calling Trump a Nazi, and you don't even flinch. You're part of a cult and don't know it. But your cult is a lot smaller than you think. That's how Trump got elected, and we will be reelected, even though all these false accusations from Russia to Stormy to payoffs to Ukraine are continuing to be made. They want him out because he's revealing all the nonsense that is part of their agenda, claiming free immigration and, yes, climate change. When you start changing China and India, then I'll listen to your one-sided story.
What does that mean?
Statements? I don't know.
What he means is, like, why should we impose rules on the United States when China and India are emitting CO2?
But you start changing China into India.
India.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought he said into India.
And India. I wrote back, and I'll try to paraphrase now. Statements like, everything you believe is a lie, is a pretty broad summary of me, don't you think? You're not the only person who said those exact words to me. I've had flat earthers, moon hoaxers, anti-vaxxers, believers in chemtrails, the 9/11 conspiracy. All of them tell me what I believe is a lie. You are now in questionable company. Sadly, what you believe in is no different. He goes, wow, flat earthers, because you don't accept the idea that people will do almost anything for power and or money.
What?
Yeah, he's basically saying, I can't believe, I refuse to believe that all of this nonsense is true because I don't believe that people will do anything for power and money. So,
do you think that that list that you gave him of the flat earthers, the truthers, the he probably believes in a few of those things.
No, I'll tell you what, I'm pretty sure he doesn't. Okay. And this is the remarkable thing about this. And a couple more things. So you are the flat earther because you believe the false connection between CO2 and the Earth's warmth without question. And I said, without question, all I do is question. It's my job. You are aware of what I do, right? So then now the links start. Boom, he starts hammering me with links. He talks about Joe Bastardi, who is this complete, anti-global warming kook, who has all this crap. He has a website, and you just see him posting stuff to make himself famous. Mm-hmm. And then he goes, and you've never heard of him. He's sure of it, just like the millions of others who've never heard of him. And I said, I know all about Joe Bastardi. He's a climate denier, and he clearly doesn't understand the science. He also is in the extreme minority. I'm worried that you're listening to people like him and ignoring the vast majority who completely disagree. And then this thing, I mean, I can. There's pages of this. It goes off the rails. But
It goes
completely off the rails. The problem I have with doing this, and one, it is pretty much a waste of time. He's got a lot of people that read what he writes. So I'm writing more to them.
Oh, yeah.
And what's funny is I'll get people that are, when we get really heated, they'll write in and go, Frank, I mean, I don't believe everything that Jay says, but I do believe blah, 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 because as a fireman, I know blah, blah, blah. So they'll throw in their little sliver of expertise.
And Frank says, you're dead to me or something like that.
And every time... Like, he doesn't address what they see. He really just links them, too. Then they're kind of, oh, they've clicked down. Now they're, oh, what are you, a liberal now? Because anybody that doesn't believe in him is liberal. So here's the thing. This is what he believes. And this is the truly scary part. I was describing to him the idea of a conspiracy theory and what does it mean to be, what is a conspiracy theory? What are the hallmarks of a conspiracy theory? And I'm trying to tell him, like, this thing that you're saying is a conspiracy theory because you believe in a global liberal Illuminati.
Yeah.
Anything that is non-conservative in the American sense, he believes all scientists that are, like, for example, all climate scientists are being controlled or paid off globally. I said, so let me get this straight. The United States Democratic Party, who you say all the time are filled with morons and assholes and idiots, they are so savvy at manipulating every scientist in the world, and they have the money to do it and the will to do it. And yet, because that there I can't believe, but and yet not one person in the last, I don't know, how long has this been going on, 20, 30 years? Not one person said, I was paid off by the Democratic Party to lie about my research for the past 15 years. I'm like, do I have to say that we couldn't keep a blowjob in the White House under wraps? Two people knew about it, and it got out.
The head of the CIA had an affair.
Yeah.
The head of the CIA was caught having an affair.
He's got all the equipment.
Literally.
That's what Jay said.
Jay, that's a false flag, right? So that happened so that we would dismiss the conspiracy.
That's true.
So a couple observations. So, there are different flavors of people who believe sets like this, and there are people who are generic all-purpose conspiracy theorists who will believe in any conspiracy because that's the thing that they believe in.
Yeah.
That's not what Frank is. There are people who are ideologues, right, who have a tribe, who have a narrative, right, and they believe that. Yeah. And that becomes,
Now, he told you and me, right, when we had a holiday, he tells Steve, I'm arguing with him, we're eating, I'm like, hey, isn't it crazy that I was so generous. I'm generous beyond generous. Yeah. And this is the way this is the way that you got to be. I said to him, hey, isn't it crazy that like you and I have these completely different points of view, but the internet confirms what we believe. You can go out and be so convinced.
Right.
And I threw that out there just as kind of like, come on, let's agree on that, at least. Let's enjoy the food and meatballs and get over
and then he
this
said, why'd you call me Frank?
10 minutes later.
And it's not my name.
10 minutes later, Steve's like creeping over on my deck, comes over, and then he waits for the right moment, then he jumps in, and then I just get up and I leave. Because that's what I wanted to have happen.
Tag.
And then I come back out, I get more food, I come back out, I sit down, and other people are yelling at each other now. We're getting a little heated. And then he goes, Steve goes, well, what would convince you? Just tell me, what would convince you? And he
basically said,
to paraphrase it though, I said, yeah, but you know, the thing, the difference is that there are actual scientific studies which show X, whatever we were talking about. And he's like, I don't believe in studies.
Where do you go? Where, how
believe,
do you deal with it?
I don't believe in
how
studies.
How do you deal with it?
What do we do?
You could walk away and yeah, I mean, that's, okay
those, like, those, right, are, those are
it's
the,
an impasse.
I guess, and the question impasse there is like, what is your understanding of the scientific method?
Yeah.
Like, what do you think it does? What do you think it shows? Like,
I think the process that he's undergoing, which is an extreme example of a process that we're seeing in many forms, is can you start with your conclusion, right? Mm-hmm. And it supports your tribe, your ideology, your religion, your whatever your narrative is, whatever your belief is. That's your starting point, mm-hmm, right? Not the ending point of some process. And then anyone who disagrees with that, you have a reason to explain their disagreement.
Yeah.
They are part of the liberal conspiracy, right? That's his explanation. So anyone who disagrees with him is liberal. And any information that disagrees with them is part of a liberal conspiracy.
Yeah,
that's it. That explains all facts.
It's a
bulletproof, you know, what we call insulated, self-referential belief system. That's what all conspiracy theories are. And there's no way to get somebody out of that.
No, because it's
impossible by definition. By that's the feature of it. You have to get out of the whole thing and convince them about the phenomenon of conspiracy thinking, you know, and usually you're only going to do that on issues that they're not already locked in at. So you have to engage with him on something that you can agree on and get him to understand conspiracy thinking in general in the hopes that he'll be able to apply it to himself, which I think the probability is vanishingly small that it'll happen in this particular case.
Yeah.
But I think that's the only pathway out of Frank.
Well, because it's almost like after we're trying to fix something after fact, and the question is like, why? How was he so failed?
Yeah.
In his ability to develop critical thinking skills and to think. I mean, not that everybody who leaves a basic education should be able to be a working scientist, but have a basic view, even if they don't call it the scientific method,
but
have a basic understanding.
Yeah, the
of
thing
that
is, he's educated.
But that's a frame through which you think. So it's one thing to compartmentalize knowledge. Mm-hmm. It's another thing to, how do you compartmentalize procedural
thought.
You can do it.
So you're, again, you're assuming a level of critical thinking that's not
That's what
there.
I'm saying. Yeah. How did the system fail him so much that he didn't develop basic critical
lack
thinking?
Lack of metacognition, right?
Yeah.
So he's not thinking
like
about the thinking
issue.
Process itself.
And his motivated reasoning is so epically powerful. Yeah. And I will give you one more piece of information, and I think this is relevant, and it's very super related to the experience that a lot of us are having today in the political environment that we're dealing with, where a lot of these people are from the 50s and 60s. And, you know, I see him sending emails that harken back to, like, it's always the sentimental thing about the 50s. Yeah. Wasn't it great when an old, you know, shows like an old gas pump and, you know, malt shakes and all this
unless
stuff?
Unless you were black or a woman.
That's right.
Or a Muslim.
Right.
Or a child.
You just had that on your show, I think. But I'm seeing those emails because I'm on his email group. I see all of his emails, all of the stuff he sends out to the people. Well, it's like watching this amazing car crash.
But you're right. People, even my age, which I'm not, I think I might barely qualify as a millennial. I'm like in between millennial, Gen X. We don't have those kinds of arguments. Yeah. We have other kinds of arguments. And there are some there are conspiracy theorists everywhere. But like, that's like a very boomer.
But it's resistance
not
to
all
change.
Boomers. I'm just saying within.
Is that
I'm
your
saying,
okay boomer moment?
No, but that's the thing.
We had three channels. Three.
There's nothing about being a boomer that makes you think this way, but for some reason, thinking this way seems to happen more of that. It's a nostalgia for a time that we didn't live through.
Yeah,
I think.
And we might have it when we're really old. But
that happened.
Yeah. Remember podcasting? Oh, I remember that stuff. Yeah, it was so good.
And it also seems like there must be like a kind of an intrinsic psychological process in which tribalism is what it is. We understand it to some extent. And obviously this person is very tribal in that way. But like, what is it about needing to belong that's so much more of a driving factor than, you know, any of these other,
I think it's more complicated than just needing to belong. I mean, I think it's part of their self-identity.
It is. That's exactly like, I am no one if not for these views. But it is a complicated thing, right? Because I think there's a morality that drives tribalism usually, mm-hmm. that people identify, like, these are my ethics, these are my morals, these are the rules with which I live my life. And it's always been a little bit difficult for me to understand. I try my best to empathize, but it's a little bit difficult for me to understand a driven morality that is so lacking in morality.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's like what's so difficult for me is when somebody's so fundamentally tied to like an immoral or an amoral view.
There are certainly belief systems that stress the limits of human gullibility, motivated reasoning. Like I think, you know, recently the test for us has been the flat earthers, right? Mm-hmm. Which we're going to get to in a moment. But the fact that people could get to the point where they think the earth is flat, you know, pushed the limits of what even I thought as a jaded, experienced skeptic, motivated reasoning was capable of. You know, it's capable of much more than we ever imagined. Yeah. And I think we're seeing this now just in a slightly different context, more in the political, ideological context.
I mean, look, let's call it like it is. If people truly converted from believing into a spherical earth to a flat earth, motivated reasoning and the other psychological components that add up to this could convince you of literally anything.
Yeah, of course.
There's literally
that's
no
how
limit.
Cults work.
Yes.
I mean, that's how, you know, it's like you take somebody away from other knowledge. You put them into an isolation chamber and you spend long enough, you know, convincing them that up is down and down is up and they will actually see the world through those glasses. I mean, it's happened throughout all of human history.
It happened in Star Trek. We look at Captain Picard. There are four lights. There are four lights. He believed it.
That person knew what you were talking about.
They all did.
Yeah, right?
It's sort of weaponizing.
Okay, boomer.
It's weaponizing the vulnerabilities of human psychology and belief formation.
Yeah, yeah. It's nefarious.
We have flaws in how we form our beliefs, and this is like a cult.
Yeah, historically,
they know it's a self-imposed cult.
Yeah, historically, you used to have to like take people and put them in a space, a physical space that's separate from the rest of society.
Yeah,
now we can have virtual cults.
But it's remarkable too.
Yeah, internet.
They love it. It's not like you go to Scientology, you got you out working in a wheat field, and you're not eating. Like, you know, Scientology.
But no, most cults, people love it.
Yeah.
Like
they are abused.
Their perception is that they found this new freedom that everybody else. Yeah. You're,
and that they're
too bad
somehow,
for you. You're not enjoying what I'm now enjoying.
They're somehow closer to something that is
truth.
Deified.
They know the
it's
truth.
Like they're on a higher level than everybody else.
I'm inherently uncomfortable.
Just like
we're talking about
feel.
Politics. I don't want to.
We're right
to go in here.
But we could talk about on the critical thinking realm.
But the thing is, I mean, look, I have to say this because I got to show my love and respect for this person. This is the kind of guy that when my wife and I bought our house, he came and spent 3 months in my house helping me set it up. Mm-hmm. This same guy. Mm-hmm. My father was one of the best human beings. I mean, of course, I think this way about my dad. But my dad was like, hands down, the most generous person any of us will ever have known.
Yeah.
You know, we can't treat these people badly. We can't treat them. You got to try not to get angry. I mean, I wanted you to hear what I wrote because those were like the third things I wrote, not the first thing I wrote back.
And there's a little anger in there too. You didn't completely purge the anger out of that.
I couldn't.
No.
I actually told him, he was discrediting like, you know, my job and what I do and science, and I get a little prickly about that. But I tried so hard to tell him over and over, hey, I'm just trying to help you. I'm worried that you're believing in this stuff and everything.
No, but you're right though, but this is a fantastic experience from their perspective, right? So think about it. All cognitive dissonance is washed away. It's gone, right? The dopamine surge they get when they hear exactly what they want to hear on every level. I'm reaffirming your identity, your superiority, your sense of control, your sense of understanding. There's no cognitive dissonance. Yep. You don't have to, none of this mamby-pamby compromising or trying to, you know, accommodate your views with legitimate but different perspectives of other people. All the work is gone. Yep. It's just, it is mind candy. It's mind crack.
Yep.
What Fox News and these outlets are doing, and they are addicted to it. Yeah. Absolutely.
It would be like me believing that when somebody tells me, whatever you eat today, don't count towards calories.
Doesn't count towards calories.
I would be like, oh my God, George, come on. Like, I'm going nuts.
I also think, though, it's important to remember that, like, there's two sides to this coin. You specifically were making the point that, like, these people might be fundamentally good people who are misled in this one way. And, you know, coming from like more of a psychotherapy perspective, of course, there's this view of like all people are equal, right? And like there's basic humanity to everybody. And I want to understand somebody and meet them halfway or meet them where they're at. at the same time, there's this ambivalence because I think that's a common trope of like, well, that guy might be racist, but he's a really good guy. Yeah. And I think that there is this kind of how much of their behavior is linked to their moral viewpoints.
Totally right.
And I mean, so I think we have to square
those circles.
It doesn't let them off
the hook. It's nuanced. But there is a difference. I do think there is a difference in some way between someone who knows that they're conducting malfeasance and someone who is generationally from a time that is just, they're, you know, I hate to say it, but he's just outdated. You know, the world has changed and a lot of people
haven't.
But that's
part of the crack, though, is that they're being told the stuff that you that felt right to you when you were 20, that's still right. Yeah. You don't have to update yourself
at
the time.
And that's the unfortunate thing is that it's not, the difference isn't it was okay then and it's not okay now. The difference is it wasn't even okay then, but somehow we allowed it as a society. Yes. And that's what we have to come to grips with. And it's very hard for us.
It's very hard. It's also challenging because the more we try to say that's not okay, that's been turned into a culture war. Mm-hmm. They see that as a personal attack on their identity, their culture, everything.
Yeah, because they're perpetrating
it. You're not okay. You're wrong.
Yeah. And so that just reinforces it. So again, that you're just playing into
they dig their heels in.
What they've already been. Yeah. Yes. That is definitely a dig your heels in scenario, which I'm going to get to a little bit later as well. Let's pivot to George. Tell us what you got. When have you had to confront?
So what I wanted to talk about is snark. Snark is...
That's the stuff that comes out your nose?
Exactly. Snark is the opportunity, obviously, to be kind of funny, to be kind of above the fray, to use hopefully some intellectual wit and some humor to cut someone down and to kind of dismiss their comments. And it's when you do it well or when you come up with a great line, in the same way you get that dopamine hit when you're watching Fox News, you get that dopamine hit and you feel really good in the moment. And I wanted to talk about how ultimately snark is kind of useless and kind of pointless. And this example is kind of the last time I used snark. I wrote a song called Thoughts and Prayers. It's actually called The Least That You Can Do, to not give away the joke. But the joke of the song is that I've discovered this amazing cure for everything. It'll solve all your problems. You get to the chorus, and it's Thoughts and Prayers. Simple, right? So that's the song. And I made a little video for it just in my living room with some flashing lights and posted it up on YouTube. And the song basically just says that like, you know, wouldn't it be nice if people did stuff as opposed to just say thoughts and prayers? Because when you say thoughts and prayers, another dopamine hit, it makes you feel good in the moment, and your responsibility kind of is done, and you kind of move on. And isn't it a shame that maybe go volunteer somewhere, or maybe give someone a call, or maybe do some kind of a something? That was the point of the song. So I posted this, and I got an email from someone that viewed it. And I won't go super in detail, but it said, regarding your cute little song. Which is the way to start any kind of...
Is this someone you know?
No, this is a random person on the internet.
Frank.
Yeah. Yeah, this is Frank. This is Frank's son, probably. No. People often could do more to respond to some unfortunate situations and meaningful actions. But tell me, for people who are in a position where there's nothing that can actually be done for a situation but offer words of support, what are they supposed to say according to you? Please provide your ideal script or words, and by all means, don't allow others to have theirs. Also, ask yourself, are you overlooking that many churches across the country collectively and quietly send large sums of money to relief efforts of all kinds, and that many people offering thoughts and prayers donate to those churches? They're not advertising or bragging about it. The media sure aren't interested in tracking that information down or reporting it. I feel you are wrongfully, brashfully, and gleefully mocking a lot of people. Free speech. That's your right, but sorry, you're wrong. The left screams tolerance. Pfft.
How do you spell that?
P-F-F-F. So I said, because I put my snark helmet on and did my snark calculations and tried to get going, because that's the response of
So when you heard this, did you feel like it was cruel? Like, was there a part of you offended by it?
Well, a little bit. As someone that's created something and someone says that creation that you've made is cute.
Yeah. Objectively wrong.
Objectively wrong. You kind of, as you jump into that seventh grade position of just like, I don't want, you know, a little bit.
Yeah.
But mostly it was like, you really didn't get it because I didn't say any of the point is that people do stuff and that's what you should be doing as opposed to just blanketly saying at a press conference, thoughts and prayer. So I said, I'm calling him Sam in this. His name wasn't Sam. I said, feel better, Sammy? Glad I could help. Wait, let me try this. And then all caps. Tolerance! Ah, now I feel better too. Thanks. Hugs, Gio. He wrote back, well, you didn't answer a single question. Instead, just a snarky response. Typical. Too bad you feel the need to write songs that take pot shots at complete strangers over things you haven't really thought. That's willful ignorance, Georgie. And a telltale sign of someone who hasn't mentally made it out of seventh grade. Sucks to be you.
All right, so far I like this guy.
Yeah. So I responded. I said, he spelled Georgie, G-O-R-G-Y. I said, first off, it's G-E-O-R-G-I-E. And here's some answers. And I answered some of the stuff that he asked. So, like, you know, are you overlooking churches? I said, actually, I talked about people volunteering, that's important. Many people offer thoughts and prayers, donor to those churches. That's not a question, even though you put a question mark at the end of it. These are all questions my seventh grade level of writing apprehension was able to glean from your communique. I think the snark was started by you when you used the words cute, n'est-ce pas? Hope you enjoy your day. So then he replied with another thing, and for some reason I just started taking a turn. He was like, no, your snark started this because you penned the song. However, since you're into writing songs that take cheap pot shots and phrases, you should consider writing one about Allahu Akbar. So I'm like, oh, okay, because, you know, you got to make fun of Muslims too. You got to make fun of Muslims. Yep. If you're going to make fun of Christians, you got to make fun of Muslims. Otherwise, it's part of the big liberal whole sort of thing. So I took this turn, and I pictured this guy sitting with his MAGA hat, and I kind of took this slight turn, and I said, oh, Sam, you will never enjoy anything. You must be in such pain. I'm really sorry at whatever happened to you. Honestly, I take no pleasure in this, George. He quickly replied, and we're going back and forth. We're just like snapping back and forth. He says, you assume too much. Get over yourself. And I followed up. I said, there it is, such anger and sadness. I'm really sorry. So then I started realizing, I looked at his domain, and it was this, like, it was a web address, growintel.com or something. And so I'm starting to investigate, and it's one of these, like, you get a website, and you get an email, and you're selling vitamins, and you're selling protein shakes on a thing, you know?
Pyramid scheme.
Right.
Yeah.
So I took a stab. I said, look, I know you're upset because the whole selling vitamins and supplement things didn't work out.
Yeah, baby.
That's awesome.
Sledgehammer.
That's awesome, man. Oh,
shit. But you have to know that even though it may feel good in the short term, writing to strangers to berate their creations won't help you in the long run. It's best for you to go out and get some exercise or paint a mural or volunteer somewhere and legitimately feel good about yourself. I wish you nothing but success. So it's still kind of snarky. It was pretty.
There's snark.
I mean, at this point, George, and I hate to say this, like, this is mean. Like, between both of you. You're both being really mean to each other.
But it takes a turn here.
Okay, yeah, we're not endorsing what we're hearing.
Yeah.
No, this is why. Well, just wait. Let me. Yeah.
Good.
No, this is going somewhere.
And this is why this was the last time I was snarky. Like, literally, this was the last time I was snarky. So it kind of kept going. We got into slightly some more details. I, again, kind of ended this one thing with, like, yeah, good luck with the protein shakes. Then he wrote me once more. Indeed, people say thoughts and prayers a lot. All I wanted to know is, for someone who went out of their way to write and record a song about it and post on the web, what would you have them do or say differently, especially when there's little else to do other than offer some kind of sentiment? Many people are broke and live hundreds of miles away. When my granddaughter died at 2.5 of brain cancer a year and a half ago, my daughter and I appreciated hearing those sentiments much better than if people said, too bad your kid is dead, or hey, people die, or damn, what shitty luck, pal. I launched 3 successful fundraisers through a restaurant franchise, a car motorcycle show, and a community dance for my granddaughter while she was in Denver receiving treatment. I'm a guitarist and a singer, and also use that to some extent for fundraising. Now, a lot of the same people who express those kind of sentiments contributed. Most people do. If pointed to a readily available way to help, they help. I suppose I could have cherry-picked the ones that didn't and gave them hell over it, or maybe sent out some kind of broad, crass message saying how ungrateful I was to those who didn't help beyond their words, had no desire to do so. So he goes on to sort of say that he and his wife have created this fund in the name of his granddaughter. And that's when I realized this is a human individual who was in a lot of pain and was lashing out at some asshole across the web who he interpreted was saying, go fuck yourself because you want to pray and feel better about what's going on. Yeah. And that's when I took this turn. And so I said, Sam, this was the last sort of exchange. I said, this explains so much. I can't even begin to imagine the pain you went through and undoubtedly will continue to go through. I have nothing but the deepest and sincerest wishes that you and your family can get through this trauma with each other. I'm sorry that my song touched a nerve, but I'm glad to know you and your story. I'm sure that having our granddaughter in your life, albeit for such a short time, was a precious gift beyond my comprehension. I delivered a talk a few years ago about loss and how individuals without faith can try to deal with it. Even though I assume that you are somebody that believes, you may find a few of my sentiments interesting or not. I humbly offer you this. And this was a talk I did in Australia about not believing in an afterlife and also not having a, but dealing with grief. In this talk, I discuss some of the very topics you bring up, including what I prefer to say when trying to offer compassion and condolences. Let me again express my sincere condolences. And he wrote back very quickly and he said, thank you. I will check it out. And thanks for your condolences. Somehow I knew we could end this on a friendly, civil note. And I concluded by saying it's nice to be reminded there are feeling humans behind all the typing on both sides. Yeah. Again, take care. Yeah. So it really made me take a step back. And yeah, to deliver a great funny line and to take someone down a peg feels great. There's that little part of you that just enjoys it. And you get the good line and you get the laugh and you forward it to your friends and you say, look how great this was. But there are living, feeling Franks and Sams and Marys and Todds on the other side of these things. And I think we need to doubly be cognizant of that as critical thinkers and as skeptics and step back and say, you're in pain for some reason. Sarah Silverman, who's a comic, did this wonderful thing that it happened after this exchange happened, but that also influenced me tremendously. She posted something about, she commented on something that she was against or whatever it was she had a problem with. And someone posted just the C word, just right back at her, just said, right at her, right? And Sarah Silverman said, what's wrong? How can I help? Yeah. And the guy's like, F you, C word. She's like, seriously, what's wrong? Like, you must be in pain. And again, F you, C word, liberal C word, F you. She's like, something's going on. Tell me what's up. And he comes back and he says, I've had back trouble forever and it's just a real pain because I can't afford back surgery. Well, long story short, she goes to all of her Twitter followers. They find someone to help this guy. They find a doctor to help fix his back. He completely turns around and says, yeah, I was in pain. I was lashing out because it was, again, the dopamine hit that was easy to do in the minute. Liberal Hollywood elite, I'm going to call her a C word and feel good for 2 seconds because the rest of my life is pretty shitty. Patton Oswalt's done the same thing too. He's raised money for people that have called him an asshole. He's like, something's wrong. What's wrong? What can we fix? And he tells his Twitter followers, hey, everybody throw $5 at this guy because he has no health insurance. And that to me, the response that the true believer comes back with is overwhelming. And in the same way that, Jay, when you say this person was at my house for 3 months helping me set up, it's the same thing. It's much harder to do because snark is easy in the minute and you just do it. But we should really focus our attention and our efforts into taking a step and going, these are human beings that are that are misled on some level. So
does the internet sort of provide cover in a sense for us to be snarky?
Of course.
Because what would you say to that person if they were looking at you in the eyes?
Yeah, the difference between being online and being in a room together is the difference between being behind the wheel of your car and being in an elevator with somebody. Like, you're going to treat them
differently. When I have an online conversation with someone, I try to I'm going to say to them what I would say to them if I was face to face.
Yeah, that's a good rule of thumb.
So I got, and it helps.
The email that I got that was the most explicit for this was I got a completely hateful email from somebody about, I'm a shill, all that. It's all the usual stuff. And I responded, so this is my approach, right? Because I agree with the lesson that you're teaching here completely. And I've tried to learn this lesson myself. Because 20 years ago, I was on the snark end of the spectrum, and I've been moving it towards the other end the whole time. My first response is always as professional and friendly and
charitable
as I can be, right? Principle of charity, just assume, like, what's the best possible argument I can make from what they're saying, and then let me address it in a calm, professional way. It's completely disarming when you do that.
Yeah, you answer most of the emails that you get that. I mean, they're terse. They're short because
it depends. But sometimes it requires a little bit longer response or whatever.
But they're super professional.
Their response was, I didn't realize it was an actual person at the other end of this email. I just thought I was sending this off into the ether, So that's part of it too. Like, they're not even thinking that there's a person at the other end.
Like a robot.
Like, you remember Tell the Girl? Like, this happens all the time.
Tell that woman.
And then the
love your show, but tell the girl not to talk.
And then
so
the
much.
Woman responds like, "Do you think I don't get these emails too?" Like,
tell the woman.
But that's the thing. They don't, I mean, as
the
a
girl at sgu.com.
This a woman,
tell Rebecca
on
that
the internet.
She needs to.
I mean, as a woman on the internet, like, I think that one of the things that's frustrating about this is that it's a hundred times worse we've all been in that position where we've had really horrible things said to us. Like, and it's hard to pick and choose. Sometimes people, you know, when somebody's like making like violent rape threats at you and you're like, are you just having a bad day?
Right.
Like maybe, and there have been times where I've been in a position where I could say like, you know, that's really hurtful what you just said to me. Like I was really trying, I was putting myself out there, I was being really vulnerable. And I've had people come back like, Jesus, I'm so sorry. I was having a really bad day at work. Of course you're a real person. Of course I should have said that. And that's been really wonderful. But then there are also times when people are like just hateful. Yeah. And it's, and it's like, am I putting myself into a position where I'm just like taking the hate? So one of the things I often tell my female colleagues who work in SciComm and who are getting larger followings is that you have to be in a psychological headspace. It's easy when people say, don't read the comment. Don't feed the trolls. That's also really annoying, guys. Like when I'm online and like I am having a comment, people are like, don't feed the trolls. I'm like, how about you not condescend to me and tell me how to handle my own
shit? I know what a troll is.
Yeah, exactly. Like I'm working, you know, it's my,
I'm working it.
My jam. But what I tell them often is that like, make sure you're in the right headspace to read the comments because you have to have a little bit of like, thick skin that day. Yeah, if you're not, if you know you're going to take something like really,
don't respond to emails
when I'm in the mood. It's like, don't go shopping when you're hungry.
Yes. I mean, I got thank you.
I gotta tell you, Steve,
to say.
When you responded that way to my shill email, I stopped sending emails like that.
That helped. So no, I think it's very. You know, I try to be productive. I don't want to waste my time.
Who has time?
The thing is, like, I don't wrestle with pigs because they're good at it and they're going to have fun. And you're just going to get dirty.
And they don't care about getting dirty.
And they don't care. They're already dirty, so it doesn't do any. It doesn't do you any good.
You know what's fun when we all get all the emails, right?
Yeah.
So it's fun because I monitor every email.
Yeah.
Even I can't respond to the vast majority, but so I'll see Steve. I'll usually see it in Google. It'll be like I could see there was like five emails. I'm like, oh. I open it up, and like I love it when it gets in there, and I can really. We got to like publish all these. Like, the end of our career. Watching Steve dissect something and respond because he's really you're so quick at it and good. It would take me. Remember, Bob and I say this all the time. That email that Steve wrote would take us hours. And Steve's doing it between 8 and 8:10 in the morning
during surgery.
So many times.
For the record, I'm not a surgeon.
We've seen people like just completely turn around to this type of response. So we do have a theme going here, which is like it's so easy for us to be a-holes. Let's not do it. Phil Plate said it. It blew my mind when I heard it. The don't be a dick thing. It also blew my mind that people got pissed about the don't be a dick speech.
Well, I think there's a lot of nuance there because. Satire's fine. Like the hopes and prayers thing, it's fine. It's satire. Some things deserve to be made fun of. But there's got to be a point to it, a lesson to it. I know that's an artistic perspective thing, the hopes and prayers. I know your point. It's the politician who has the absolute power to do something about it, who's saying hopes and prayers instead of the thing that they should be doing as cover. F you, right? I totally get that. But and now I forgot the point I was going to make. I'll get it. What were we talking about?
Well, you just love the song. You love my talent.
That was it. I just love all of you.
Steve.
Oh, no, satire's good. That's satire. Satire's fine. And but there's difference between legitimate satire as an art form, as a form of communication, and trolling.
Absolutely.
And the people don't understand the difference. People, you know, the trolling is sort of an ignorant person's view of satire.
Yeah.
It's easy. It's cheap. It absolves them of all thought and responsibility. They don't have to engage with the other person. They're just throwing up flack and causing. And that creationist, I'm forgetting his name, but I occasionally tangle with him. He shows up on the comments.
Baby.
No. The neurosurgeon creationist.
What's his name?
Our old friend.
Yeah, no, what's his name?
That guy with the eyes.
Frank. Ignore.
Dr. Ignore.
He even admits to being a troll on in the comments on our blog. He says, I like to rattle the cages and see the monkeys go crazy. It's like, oh, that's a pretty good description of being a troll.
And there's kind of the Hitchens view, right, that like there are beliefs should not be beyond ridicule. Thank you. There should be certain things that as a society we can ridicule because that's going to help keep them from reaching a critical mass.
Nothing
but at the same time, a person is not their beliefs, and you have to separate those things. But more and more, I do start to understand the view that it's hard for people to separate their beliefs from their identity. Yeah. And so ridiculing their beliefs feels like a personal attack. I think we have to be understanding.
More than ever. Yeah. Right now. Look, look, I'm going to say it like it is. Shit's going to go down in the next 2 years. Legit. It's going to be ugly. What's going to happen in our country in the next two years? No, but it's going to
get worse.
It's going to get really bad.
Before it gets better.
And we have to, this might sound condescending or making all of us sound like we're it, but we have to be the adults. Regardless of what you believe, we have to be the mature ones. Because
that's the same as in the email. Like, someone's being a child. And this is often the effect I'm going for, is that someone writes an email that's childish. It's objectively childish email. And I don't say you're being childish or whatever. I just respond as an adult. And they always get it. They always immediately go, I'm a child.
Yeah. And like,
you know, I've lost the high ground. They immediately sense that they've lost the high ground.
And it's so effective. But it's also constructive, right? So then they kind of feel pressured into being an adult. And they respond, and then, or they don't, right? And if they do, if they want to engage with me on facts and evidence and logic, we get to that end point much quicker. Yeah. Or if they're just looking to troll some anonymous guy who represents some cardboard villain that they're propping up because they represent the stuff that is against whatever they're for, I'm not interested in playing the role of a cardboard villain. Have a nice day.
I think all things being equal, there's one trait that we're talking about exercising that like we just haven't used the word, and that's just empathy. Yeah. Like I think if you're empathic in a position and you work really hard to understand where the other person is coming from, you're going to be able to recognize the difference between trolling and genuine interaction, first of all.
Pretend that you're Mr. Rogers.
Yeah. Oh my
God. That's impossible.
Did you guys see that documentary?
Yeah, yes.
Fantastic.
I cried so hard.
Look, and now the new Tom Hanks thing, I'm going to cry the entire time.
Because of Mr. Rogers, I stopped ending all my emails with hashtag suck my back.
Yeah, that's good.
I just don't do it anymore.
Because of him.
We're going to work with Jack.
Because of Mr. Rogers,
All right. Got extreme ends of the spectrum right here.
Bob, you're next. That was great, George. All right, Bob, you go.
I think we probably should have ended with George. Mine's going to be like, all right, that was nice, Bob. that was cute, Bob.
What about Evan?
Evan, next.
I have a surprise.
So,
baby.
So, climate change denial, that's cute. That's a cute grand conspiracy, but it's not the big kahuna. We all know what that is, right? We talked about it. You know, flat earthers, that's the king of the grand conspiracies. You can't really get much higher than that. I mean, come on, really?
For now. We'll see what's next.
Closed universe society? I mean, I don't know. How much should I say here?
I wouldn't identify the person.
Okay. Frank, Sam,
somebody.
You know, you're choosing somebody.
Frank,
somebody we know.
Bob, can I name them?
Ruprecht.
No.
Mickey.
All right, Mickey.
Mickey?
Close, really close. You know,
flat earth spot.
I mean,
it's a flat earth after all.
So.
I love George.
Close to the, I'll say she because that's just going to pop out of my mouth anyway. Sitting down at the table, me and her, Jay was there.
You're
going to
tell that story?
No. So we're talking about being a flat earther, and Jay starts getting into it a little bit, and then Jay just like stands up and walks out of the house. He leaves.
When you leave the room, you leave the house.
He like was not going to engage because he would have lost his shit. So he walks out, so he leaves it to me.
I had that thing where my brain went into the red. I went, bam! Like, flat earth. Like, that was the first thing we debunked 30 years ago.
Even worthy of being debunked because nobody, it wasn't even a thing. So, all right, so I'm like, I could do this. How easy is this? It's like this iPad mini's round. No, it's flat, and I'll prove it. I mean, it seems like such an easy thing, and so I was like, how hard could this be? So I'm like, all right. So I go, all right. The classic ship over the horizon, and the ship disappears, and you see just the upper part of the ship, right?
I learned that in fourth grade.
No, that doesn't happen. That doesn't happen. If you do this and that and this and because of this and that, that's not a thing. I'm like, what? All right, let's try something else. Oh, God, there's a lot of things I could say because it's so obvious, right? How hard could this be? So we're talking about other things and talking about gravity. And then oh boy, she even was like dismissing gravity.
Gravity doesn't exist.
It's like
acceleration.
Acceleration. Now, all right, there is a very interesting connection between acceleration and gravity. So they're almost indistinguishable, and that's a really interesting thing. It's related to Einstein, but she wasn't thinking about Einstein. She's thinking of her bullshit. So it's like, holy crap, where do I go from here? Well, how about like, you know, balloons that go, or things that go up in the air and you could see the curvature of the earth. Nope, that didn't go. The moon, we were on the other side of the planet and the moon was upside down. Nothing swayed her. She has an answer for everything.
Not a good answer.
Not a good answer. Here was one. How about pictures of the fucking earth? We have pictures of the entire earth. Now, she comes back with her answer. It was like, if you zoom into some of these pictures, you will see a cloud formation. And they're pretty unique, right? Then you see the exact unique...
On Google Earth.
Unique, I don't know where, but you see the exact cloud formation. And that's actually an artifact of algorithms that they ran because they took chunks of the Earth and they put it all together into one big image. And okay, that's explainable. And I can understand why you would think, well, why is that cloud identical? But there are pictures of the Earth from, like, say, the moon or from...
Single pictures.
Earthrise.
Single pictures.
Earthrise is a single photo, right?
If you zoom in, you are not going to see an algorithmic 60s. Identical clouds because it's one cohesive
picture.
It's not a mosaic. And so she comes back with that one. And it just reached a point where...
It's fake. Anything that debunks her belief system is fake.
Right. She has her conspiracy shield around her. There was nothing I could do. And I was just in shock that I couldn't make a dent. And I should have realized. You think I would have realized it. But I figured flat earthers... I mean, this is a few years ago. This is an easy one. You know, because climate change is complex. You know, climate scientists are smart. They know their shit. We have to trust... the consensus, because we really can't, dive into this, but you can dive into flat earthers and really understand why.
You don't need specialized education.
Right. You really don't.
To understand the fundamental arguments.
No, right. like 3 and 4 year olds get that the earth is round.
Yeah. Right. So at some point you've got to realize that you just got to step away. You're not going to convince them. You're not a bad scientist or skeptic if you can't convince them, because they are just in this bubble.
It's not about the facts.
This bubble of conspiracy. Right. It's about her non-critical thinking, complete unawareness of metacognition and how people can fool themselves. So she was like totally embroiled in this, and there was nothing I could do. It's like, okay.
Did you walk out of the house?
I walked away. I didn't walk out of the house, but I did cover my face a couple times hearing her answers. But I'm like, all right, I'm out of here. This is like never going to make any progress.
It's like I look back on that. I know exactly how I was feeling. You know, I just felt...
Probably was good to walk away.
It was. No, I mean, it was absolutely good.
It's
interesting to me because I feel sometimes as a highly trained skeptic and someone who really pays attention, I witness my own behavior all the time, constantly examining myself. I completely lost my shit. I went way into the red. You know, I wasn't so much afraid of what I was going to say. I was afraid of just feeling that way because I haven't felt that obsessively angry. And enraged. It was like this, like, I think I could kill someone in that moment, because to me, the flat earth thing is so unbelievable. I can believe so many things. I can put my, you believe in Bigfoot. All right. I can kind of understand that. You know, I get, all right. But I keep the flat earth thing to me, like, you think that NASA's guarding the outer rim of the ice shelf with guns? Like, you really believe
NASA?
That? Yeah, NASA. Like, what's happening when we send spaceships up? Like, you know, like the things, that the leaps of non-intellect that you have to make. What would you call that? Like the compartmentalizing and the excuse making that you have to do. It has to reverberate down into everything.
Well, there's cognitive dissonance across the board, and they're just ignoring it. They're just pushing it.
It's the massive. It's a distrust of authority on a scale that's unprecedented.
Absolute level.
And it makes sense.
Right. You distrust everybody from government, scientists, pilots. So many people
it's
in this
ultimate.
Conspiracy. It's the ultimate grand conspiracy.
In my opinion, that's, again, it's a feature, not a bug. That is the point. That's actually the point of it. Because if they could prove that the Earth is flat,
they
fundamental thing that we believe is actually completely wrong, then they have proven that everything is a conspiracy.
All of it.
They have, 100%. In one stroke, they have dismissed anything they don't want to believe.
But I understand, too, why...
Earth going around the sun, all of it.
You could fake the Earth. You could fake anything.
I get why it would make you so, like, almost violently angry, because there's almost a sickness to it. We're not talking about a random person on the internet. We're talking about somebody you're very, very close to. And when that happens...
You can't understand the anger without knowing the relationship.
It starts to feel, you know, there's the ambivalence and the real deep depths of sadness when, for example, you start to lose the sense of somebody you know to Alzheimer's or dementia, yeah, yeah. where you really start to lose a sense of who that person is. And when somebody is so disconnected from reality in a way that makes you feel almost like you don't even know them. Yeah. Like, how yeah. is it that the emotions that I've developed over a lifetime well, for you
the angle here
are being
is,
so questioned?
Let me just close out this with this mm-hmm. statement, then we'll move on to Evan, because we do have to move along. That I think Jay's anger was part of the point of all of this. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think that this is just all about the belief itself. I think that this is a feature, again, of saying, I believe that the earth is flat and everything you believe is wrong.
Oh, so it's
the
like a point, beating.
The point was to get Jay to storm out of the room angry.
Now I'm even more angry.
And you know that. All right, Evan, what do you got?
Well, so you guys told me that we were going to be doing this particular, you know, session, and this would be the theme of today. So I thought of, I think the easiest example would be people in my family, and I'm not afraid to say them, mom, two sisters, both my siblings, my mother, deep into the world of psychics. They absolutely are 100% hook, line, and sinker, each in their own way. My sister says she has the psychic ability to communicate with animals. My mom believes entirely in astrology. My other sister believes in spirits, haunting houses, and other things like that, and being able to communicate with ghosts. Okay, so maybe I'll go down that path and talk about that. I've actually talked a little bit about that before in prior private recordings like this. So I decided I think I'm going to take a little bit of a different tact here. I'm going to go with something a little bit more current, and with some family members who are a little bit closer to me, who may actually happen to be here in the room today. And I hope they don't actually disassociate with me when
do
this is all
they know that you're
done.
About to do this?
Nope.
Okay. Oh, whoa. That's...
So.
We're all just going to turn this way.
And there's a second part to this. I have, and Steve, I've expressed this to you before. I wanted us to have a Skeptics Guide show, a special show in which we speak exclusively about things we've never talked about before on the show. We choose subjects we've never spoken about A, they've never spoken about B, and that's what we're going to go into. So I'm going to do that right now with my particular example and what I'm going to speak about.
Okay.
I'm going to actually need to stand up for this.
I'm really kind of scared.
Evan, before you start, I just want to say that whoever you're talking about right now, I just want them to know how much I love them.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Whoever that person might be.
This is light. This is fun. This is not anything too serious or anything like that.
So let's
bring the pressure down. I built it up. Yes, I did. Now I'm going to deflate it just a little.
You're traveling with this person over the next 2 weeks.
Look at your wife right now.
Hey, guys, how you doing? Yeah, that's right. Oh, I know what you know. Yes, I'm
going to stand, too, because this is really weird.
This person just signaled to Evan, I know Krav Maga.
While I talk about this, I need about a minute to talk about this, and I'm going to stand here. I'm going to actually lean against this wall. I don't know if people in the back, you can see. I've got my arm here.
Yeah.
Pressed up against the wall, and I'm really exerting force. I'm trying to really exert my force with my wrist, with my hand, my palm towards me, and I'm exerting force. I'm going to do this for about 60 seconds or so.
Okay.
They know what's coming.
They're dying over
there. And while I do this, I'm going to tell you this story. So not long ago, I mean, you may not know this about me. I like to pun. All right, shock. I'm a bit of a humorist. I have a particular sense of humor. Mm-hmm. And perhaps certain people in my family know these kinds of features and qualities about me. With that, they know that I am not always the most serious of people when it comes to all things. So one day, I said, do you guys know about something called, we used to do this as a kid, it's called the floating arm trick. No. Rachel, my daughter, 16, never heard of it. Jennifer, my wife, I don't know if you heard of it prior. So, right, because this is, you know, growing up in the 70s, you know, all my friends and we're all doing this. In which you basically exert a bunch, you push your arm against a wall or inside the frame of a doorway or something. Yeah. And you can't help it. Involuntarily, your arm is going to just float up into the air. What's causing it? Is it a magic trick? What's actually going on here? So I go to demonstrate it for my family, and I do it, and they tell me they don't believe me. He said, "You're lying. No, that's not real. Honestly, you're doing that. This is not a neurophysical phenomenon. You're trying to trick us. You're playing a prank on us. This is some kind of joke. You're trying to make, you know, because that, you know, my nature is we have fun. We laugh a lot.
It's a reasonable hypothesis. A lot
of they're actually being good skeptics.
So, yeah. So they're, yeah. Absolutely. They're,
thank you, Jen.
It's a good default position.
And they say, no, no, no. So I show them. And despite me showing them what happened, still no belief in it. Mm-hmm. Every once in a while, Rachel, right, I'll bring it up to you. Hey, Rachel, you want to see the floating arm trick? Dad, don't do that. You're kidding me. You're kidding. So I raise it as a joke for the family every once in a while. So what happens is that when you exert that pressure on your arm, unless you tell your brain to stop the motion of going up, it's going to go up. In fact, what I've also read about, and this is called the Kohnstamm effect, Kohnstamm, and scientists have known about this for about 100 years or so. It's an involuntary contraction of the muscles. And when you do this particular thing, it happens in other phenomena, but this is the best example that you can show people about how this actually really is a real thing. Mm-hmm. Could not convince my family that this was a real thing. Now, and the second part of this, and I read this because Scientific American had an article about this very thing just about a year ago, and they've tested this widely. If I were to try to suppress myself from lowering my arm, my brain is actually sending a second set of signals mm-hmm. to my muscles saying, don't do what he's trying to tell you to do to bring your arm down. Override it. Continue. It's a second phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Scientists, apparently, as of last year, are still trying to figure out exactly what this phenomenon is. Steve, maybe you know a little bit more about it.
Just to broaden it out, there is a complicated relationship between voluntary and involuntary movements, right? And conscious and subconscious.
Yeah, it's like breathing.
It's like the ideomotor effect, mm-hmm. right? Are you moving the Ouija mm-hmm. planchette, or is it just happening subconsciously? How much of it is conscious, subconscious, and what is the relationship between the two? We're still sorting that out. That's like one of the most complicated things in neuroscience. Mm-hmm. Like you make decisions like seconds before you're aware that you made the decision. Who's making the decision? And why doesn't it happen every time? You're overriding it sometimes, but not other times. It's like a committee, right? That are all shouting, and something happens at the end of that, and we're still trying to sort out the pinballs are bouncing around, and something comes out the other end, and it's complicated. There's no one single answer to it. So we can identify phenomena that contribute to this overall reaction, but nothing's absolute, right? Mm-hmm. And there's so many other ways to influence it. Because we're still trying to sort out what are all the possible ways to influence it. So that's the big picture. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, that's a involuntary ideomotor type response that you can observe often enough that it's probably a thing.
Yeah, right? but individual differences.
But there's individual
for sure.
differences,
yeah.
absolutely.
So I hope I satisfied two things today. This is something we've never spoken about before on this show. And perhaps now finally, my immediate family, my
it's
wife
very
and my child. I've been able to perhaps convince them that this is actually a true scientific. Thank you. All right.
That's great. We were worried.
Right. I purposefully built it up.
Okay. All right. All right. Whoa. All right.
Sense of humor.
So I'm going to go last, because I'm the only one left. So I'm going to talk about, not medicine, I'm going to talk about creationism. Because that was my entry into skepticism, and I learned most of my fundamental lessons about skepticism from my interaction with creationists. And so I'm going to go over what I think some of those lessons are. So, like when I was in college in Baltimore in a row house, like I would be out on the stoop having a conversation with some random creationist who was coming to our door, like for hours, you know. And she was like, why are you doing that? You're never going to convince him. I'm like, that's not the point. I don't care. I know I'm not going to convince him.
Someday I'll record this and broadcast it.
No, but seriously,
I just have a sense.
Yeah, this will be useful to me someday, somehow. But I really, it was understanding the phenomenon, right? All right, yeah. But I will admit, at first, I had the Bob reaction, like, that's easy. You know? I know, it's one of the things I know a lot about. I've read many, many, many books. I've studied it since I was, young. It's one of my favorite sciences. I could talk up and down about evolution, et cetera, et cetera. I'm like, all right, so this guy just doesn't know what they're talking about. I was totally mired in the knowledge deficit model of belief in pseudoscience.
That because that was the model at the time, right? This was the Carl Sagan model. Carl Sagan, he might have been paraphrasing somebody else, but he said, you know, people believe in pseudoscience in exact proportion to they misunderstand real science. Mm-hmm. That was an explicit, you know, expression of the knowledge deficit model.
It makes sense, right?
And it makes sense. People, you're a creationist because you don't understand the evidence for evolution. I'm going to explain that evidence to you now, and then you will believe in evolution because I've explained to you
that
you're aware of the fossil evidence. Done and done. But this is where I learned how wrong that was, right? Mm. So I was able to learn that, oh, these people don't just lack information. They're full of misinformation. So that was the thing that I learned. So now I have to correct their misinformation as well as give them the real. So that's a little bit more challenging. They say there's no transitional fossils. I'm like, okay, I got this
one. I have one on my arm.
Yeah.
Wow.
There's lots and tons of great transitional fossils. But then they say, oh, yeah, but those aren't transitional. So then I realized, oh, okay, they're operating under a different definition of what a transitional fossil is. So now I have to educate them about basic concepts of science, not just the facts. But again, this is still kind of all in the knowledge, understanding, deficit model. Mm-hmm. All right, now fast forward 20 years later, and I kind of lived through this in real time, but I'm sort of cutting to the end.
Still arguing on the stoop, same person. Still,
now I'm just doing it over email, right? You guys are watching, or in the comments to my blog post, which is a lot, we get to a lot more people. But anyway, so we've done, there's been actual research, and we know that the knowledge deficit model is, in some ways, it's incorrect. In fact, if you look at belief in pseudoscience and you track it to education, it actually goes up. It keeps going up pretty much until you get to like graduate level science education. Mm. So unless you're a scientist, knowledge of science actually increases belief in pseudoscience. So how is that? That seems to fly directly in the face of the knowledge deficit model. Why is that happening? We don't know. It's a complicated thing. Again, it's probably a marker for other indirect effects, like socioeconomic status, willingness to buck authority, things like that. But it doesn't really, really chip away at belief in pseudoscience until you get to the highest levels of science education. So something else is going on here. But then what happened is science communicators and skeptics massively overcorrected, and we thought that the knowledge deficit model was completely wrong, and it isn't. It's actually partly correct. Sometimes it is a knowledge deficit, and sometimes it isn't.
It's a hybrid.
It's a hybrid. My Kara God. Just got one
I'm losing
point.
My mojo. Kara has to remind me of one of my shticks.
There's a lot more nuances. Now it's like, okay, we have to kind of go issue by issue and even person by person. Everyone has sort of their own mix of how much of this is just that you just don't know the facts, or you're operating under misconceptions, or it's a critical thinking deficit. Or
it's like a religion for you.
It's a religion. Yeah. It's whatever. Nothing's going to change your mind. It's identity. Yeah. You're going to dig in your heels, maybe even backfire. All of these things are elements, or nothing is universal. It's all individual by issue and by person. Everyone's
and even more granular than that, depending on the topic with the same person.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So it's because people are complicated.
Steve,
right?
Come on. Everybody wants to know, did you win?
Well, I mean, there is no objective winning. Of course, I thought I did. But the question is, how do you define winning? Did I win on points? Of course I did, because they're creationists. On everything, because there are transitional fossils, right?
Yeah.
So, all right, what's another lesson that I learned? You can't just know the science when you're confronting pseudoscience. You have to have specific knowledge of the pseudoscience. You have to know their arguments.
Sure. Yeah.
And you have to know, this is how Duane Gish kicked evolutionists' asses up and down the country, because he was debating people who were evolutionary biologists who didn't really know creationism.
Yeah.
And then he would do the Gish Gallop, he'd overwhelm them with misinformation, and they just couldn't deal with it, right? But you have to know not only what the science says, you have to know why the pseudoscience is wrong in detail and what they're going to say to it. For example, a creationist might say that evolution violates the second law of thermodynamics, right? We all heard that one. So you have to know why that's wrong, and you have to be able to explain to it very, very quickly why that is wrong. It's like, well, it's not a closed system, blah, blah, blah. And then they'll say, okay, but the universe is a closed system, right? Yes. So why is entropy decreasing in the universe when that's a closed system. That's one level deeper that you won't get from every creationist, but you'll get from a well-read creationist,
yes.
Right? So you have to know the answer to that. You have to say, well, yes, overall entropy is increasing, but it can decrease in one place as long as it's increasing by more.
Yes.
You could have local temporary decreases in entropy.
That's what the Earth is.
That's what the Earth is, because the sun has a greater increase in entropy to more than offset the temporary.
That's what crystals are. That's what sugar candy is.
That's what cleaning your room
then they
is.
Say, exactly. okay, but you know where they go from there? Because again, every time you'll think,
right.
I gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but that only happens when you have pre-existing specified information, right? So, like, okay, so that's how a tree can grow, right? How does a tree grow?
By seed.
A tree is a local decrease in entropy because it's using energy from the outside, right? Mm-hmm. They say, yeah, but the information for the tree is already there. Say, okay, that's a non sequitur because that's a completely separate point, right? It has nothing to do. So we're no longer talking about the second law of thermodynamics. That's like saying my favorite analogy for that, which I think I invented, is that's like saying, well, the cars don't work because the engine can't steer the car. And, you know, the steering wheel doesn't propel the car.
Steve, you never learned it, man.
Yeah.
All you got to do when they say stuff like that, every time they start talking, you just go, how about that?
That's an alternate approach that you can try.
That is a strategy.
So, but you know, the thing is, it is worth sort of going all the way through to the end and understanding it. First of all, you learn logic and critical thinking because you're deconstructing their bad logic. You learn a lot about it. You know, I think this is part of why I understand logical fallacy so
well.
You told
me that. You
have to deconstruct it.
One of those 1 hour conversations. And you would be like, oh, man, you know, like you were like taking mental notes of all the things that you didn't have answers for.
Right, well, absolutely. Yeah. You know, so you have to learn critical thinking, the specific pseudoscience and the science. You have to know all of those things together in order to effectively communicate about pseudoscience, right? So that's what skeptics do that scientists don't do.
Right.
And
it's like reading the Bible. It's like, read the Bible. Because
yeah,
it's the best thing you can do when someone is arguing some kind of religious standard. But, well, actually, this conflicts with this. So which is right? Which part is the thing?
Yeah, but it becomes difficult when we're talking about a single interaction.
Yeah.
A shortened. Yeah. I mean, I think in some ways I keep drawing parallels to therapy because a big part of what you do in therapy is work to find places where somebody is making decisions in their life that don't comport with, you know, the outcomes that they want. Or, you know, there's a lot of reasons people come to therapy. But sometimes you're helping them uncover things. But the thing is, you can't give somebody insight.
In one
you
session.
I wish you could, but you can't. You have to help them get to insight on their own.
Exactly.
And that's why therapy takes a while. And that's why these kinds of conversations are conversations that I personally, and maybe it's because I'm doing so much therapy, don't want to invest in because they can take years. Mm-hmm. And even you might not get to that.
You often say that. Like, people say, what do I do about this person? I go, what's your time frame?
Exactly. Yeah. How committed are you?
And also, you're more talking to the other people that are listening than you are to that person. Because I'll never get Frank. Like what happened with you and Sammy was different.
Mm-hmm.
That was cool. What happened between you and
Sammy?
But the thing, we've been doing this long enough. I certainly had experiences where I've been engaged in a debate with a creationist who I was able to give them information like, oh, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
I need to reevaluate what that's rare, but it's happened to me in real time. And we also get emails from people like, I was a creationist. I started listening to your show just to see how full of shit you guys were.
Yeah.
And a year later. I don't even believe in God anymore, right? We've gotten those emails. So that's like,
that's like the weekly grind.
Weekly 50, skeptical, therapy sessions.
And
later.
Slowly the plan comes together. Converting the planet one person at a time.
So the thing is, this is again, setting your goals for yourself. I never view any individual interaction as going to accomplish anything tangible or measurable or whatever.
Yeah.
But I just look at all of those interactions cumulatively, but every individual interaction, I want it to be productive and moving towards that end.
Because
you never know when it's going to bear fruit.
In fact, I would be suspect if it did work in one conversation. Like, wait, what went wrong? Something,
wrong here. You have to not expect that. You know, it is very much, at the very most you'll get, you've given me something to think about, right?
Yeah,
that's the most you'll ever get. And if I take that's like the biggest win you're going to
totally
get in the short term.
Even more than
that's
rare. You show them that somebody who disagrees with them is like a good person that's worth listening to.
Here's my anecdote for that.
Maybe you don't have time for that.
I do. We have 2 minutes because Bob can do the science fiction in 10 minutes. So we'll end up. You already agreed to this. I was invited to a homeopathy conference. Right, the whole conference was organized by homeopaths. I was the only non-homeopath on the panels and in the room. Right, I mean, every person in that room was a homeopath but me. And my job was not to convince them that homeopathy was wrong, but it was to convince them that I am not a three-headed demon who vomits
exactly.
acid, right?
Yeah.
And that was an easy thing to accomplish. All I had to do was be a nice, reasonable person.
Yeah.
And I had, you know, they were coming up to me at the end like, you were so nice and you were reasonable. I just, and then I said, well, yeah, but they said, but you're the exception, right?
And
I'm not the exception.
And you said, go f*** yourself.
But you see, the exception is how you dismiss disconfirming evidence.
Right.
That's the exception. No, it's not. It's data.
That did more good than anything you could have said about homeopathy.
It's like when I was on the Dr. Oz show, again, my job was to be nice. That was my only job.
But I do have a screenshot of you giving him this best look, because I went through every frame, and there's one point where Steve's like this. He's like...
Genius. Oh, that's great.
All right. Bob, you're going to close us out with a science fiction...
It's time for science or fiction.
Come on, all right, please. Science or fiction.
Yes, here we go.
9 minutes.
Too much.
You gotta be the quickest one ever, right?
Yes. All
right,
here we go.
True.
Science fiction, LA. All right, science fiction. All right, number one. There's four of these. Fun facts.
There are four facts.
Four facts.
There are four lights.
Three.
Fun facts about LA. Yes. When L.A. was founded, the city's full name was El Pueblo de Nuestra Señora Reina de Los Angeles sobre el Río Portiuncla. That translates to, sorry for my pronunciation, I think I got some, most of the words, the town of Our Lady Queen of...
Portcullis.
Portcullis, yeah.
Some pork river, okay. So, number two. By 1923, Los Angeles produced one quarter of the world's oil. It still sits atop the third largest oil field in the country. Mm-hmm. Number three. Wow. In 1973, pranksters changed the landmark sign... to read Hollyweed. And four, the LA area is the second most crowded metropolitan region in the United States.
Damn. Oh, you do the audience.
We've got 8 minutes here.
Yeah, right. Let's just do it.
All right.
We'll just do the audience once at the end after we talk. All right.
Okay. I think everything else is true except for the LA area is the second most crowded. I think it's a little bit of a skewed, it's probably third or first or something like that. So I think everything else is good. The name, the oil, the pranksters, I think those are all good. So I'm going to say four. Four is the fiction.
Steve.
I was kind of agreeing with that, too. I mean, the name definitely, because, you know, you might have come up with that from a real source, but have it not be the full name. But, yeah, I could believe that. A quarter of the world's oil, 1923. Okay, 23, sure. Third largest in the country, sure. Alaska, Texas, then California, sure. Pranksters, wasn't it Hollywood Land at some point?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Originally,
then they got rid of land.
But Hollywood, how would you make... I guess you could make O's into E's pretty easily. Hollyweed. So that sounds plausible. Never heard that, but that sounds plausible. And Kara's always complaining about the traffic in L.A.
Not just Kara.
Anyone?
But yeah, it could be the first. You know, but I think Boston's the most crowded.
Boston.
Boston?
New York? I don't know.
Try to Pocky Ka in Boston, man. I'll agree with George. I'll go with the crowded thing. Is not real.
The first one.
Can I read that?
Yes, absolutely. It's definitely a pork river. I totally agree.
El pueblo de Nuestra Señora Reina de Los Ángeles sobre el río Porquincula.
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 Yes, I agree with that one. That's science. Los Angeles produced one quarter of the world's oil. I agree with that, but it's not the kind you put in your cars. It's actually face oil. 1973, pranksters changed the landmark to read Hollyweed. Yes. The LA area is the second most crowded metropolitan region in the world. Yes, because it would have to be in order to produce that much oil.
Wait, so which one's the fiction?
That was all. Which one's the fiction?
Jay, all right. One of these four is fiction.
You're on the game, Wordstrom?
Number five.
I'll go with George.
It's only his 700th episode. Come on.
750. This is 750 what, Steve?
This is 750. Well,
it depends when it releases.
It'll be 750.
We don't have time. Okay.
756, 7.
There are a lot of oil derricks in New York or in LA. I don't know if the numbers are right, but you see them like anytime you fly into LAX, you see drilling for oil. I have no idea if this was the name of the fort. I would assume, though, it's a pueblo, like everything around here was. So could be, could be not. Hollyweed, I remember that happened. And
oh, there you go, Evan.
I think there's no way it's the second most crowded metropolitan region because it's huge. LA is enormous in terms of landmass. Yes, we have a lot of people, but if you think about New York, which is 8 miles by 3 miles or something like that.
That's number one.
Yeah, that's number one. Right. But there are tons of small towns that have really high populations relative to the landmass. The LA area is the second most crowded metropolitan region in the U.S.
So define LA area?
I mean, yeah, that probably means LA county. You mean LA county, right? It's the metroplex.
It's density. I'm talking density.
You're talking population density. Yes. So right. Per square foot. The number of people. I absolutely don't think that that's... No. Yes, we're the second... I know we're the second most populated city in the country, but we're also enormous compared to a lot of other small cities, so I think that our density is probably lower.
I don't need that. I agree. Okay.
Wait, so density is lower, so what's your answer then?
So my answer is that's the fiction, because you said it's the second most crowded. I think it's probably like six.
So we all agree.
Yeah.
We all agree.
I'm going that way as well,
did
Bob.
We sweep or did Bob sweep us?
Yeah, do the audience. Okay, yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah.
You know about the single clap, right? So let's just practice together. Here we go, clap. Okay, that's how you vote. So, read it.
Okay.
Oh.
Pueblo.
So, when it was founded, the name was the Pork River thing. Okay. Right. Oil produced quarter of the world's oil, 23. Okay.
I like I like your independence. Right.
Good for you.
I like it. That was adorable.
For you. Holly Weed.
I like it. I like
that person's high right now. And second most crowded area.
All right. Bye, man.
What if I was wrong and it was like Holly Wooglin?
I know, yeah.
I don't remember.
He's really happy.
Oh, no.
Did he sweep up? Maybe it's the Pueblo.
What are you doing to us? All right, so what? Blah, blah, blah. Blah, blah.
Kaffa.
Okay. The first one, L.A., with that long name, that's correct. It was founded in 1781. There were only 44 people or 14 families living.
Wow.
They settled in the area known as El Corazon. In downtown L.A., and it was named by Felipe de Neve, governor of Spanish California.
Very cool.
And obviously the name shrank to what it is today. One quarter of the world's oil. That's correct. That surprised
me. That's amazing.
A quarter of the world's oil.
Wow.
But oil production in 1923.
I know, but still, it's a lot.
You can't count
Beverly Hills.
It's
like pre-industrial.
I'll build a pipeline all the way to the ocean. Yeah, they
didn't know all. And then Hollyweed. Yeah, that's true. That was awesome. You heard about it?
Yeah, I was here. What year was that?
No. Oh, wait. What do you think?
2004?
70s?
Oh, 70s.
I thought it was more recent.
I thought it was more recent.
It happened twice. Yeah, I think it happened recently, too.
Maybe,
Hollywood land was taken down, right?
And then that was a long time
and then,
ago.
And then they made it Hollyweed, and then somebody burned one of the letters. Then they took it down. It was gone.
It was under construction since I've lived here. Somebody defaced it, and then they had to fix it.
But the sign was gone for the first time in 50 years.
Don't forget Hollywood.
And Hugh Hefner actually is a guy that spearheaded the thing to get Hollywood signed back up.
Yeah.
He had parties, and it was like $27,000 per letter.
You can't go there anymore. You used to be able to hike to it, but now it's like there's fences and stuff.
Which means I've totally screwed up, and everybody swept me. Whatever. all right. So the LA area. Thank you. Could you scratch while you're back there?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
is the most crowded metropolitan region in the United States. And it says, it sounds like a mistake, but according to the U.S. Census, the Los Angeles, Long Beach, Anaheim region has an average density of nearly 7,000 people per square mile. Despite super compact Manhattan, the average overall density of the entire Newark region is only 5,300 people per square mile. So in terms of that, so
it's by region, not necessarily by downtown area.
Well, yeah, that's why I said area, L.A. area. Yeah.
How is that even possible?
So we were right.
Number one, the density is number one.
There are more people and New York is smaller.
But they're counting like the whole area.
LA. Yeah, but even the L.A. area is 13 million, right? Or 11 million?
This is the U.S. Census.
Yeah.
So
that's so strange.
Yeah, so we were right for the wrong reason.
We were right for the wrong reason, like we usually are.
I'll take that. I'll take it.
Everyone won. Bob lost.
Everyone won.
Everyone's a winner.
Everybody gets laid.
Yeah. Everybody's
a good word.
Except me, right?
Evan, give us a quote.
Let's hope that Lysenko's success, air quotes, success, in Russia will serve for many generations to come as another reminder to the world of how quickly and easily a science can be corrupted when ignorant political leaders deem themselves competent to arbitrate scientific disputes. Martin Gardner.
Yay.
Martin Gardner. We love Martin Gardner.
Yeah, Marty. Yeah, Marty.
All right, this has been a lot of fun. So thank you guys all for joining me, and thank you all for joining us. We had a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.